Welcome, everybody, to Capital Link's Shipping Sector Webinar Series. I am Ken Hoexter, BofA Bank of America Securities Air Freight and Surface Transportation and Shipping or Marine Transportation Analyst. I'm your moderator for today's Container Ship Sector Panel. Today's webinar is going to discuss trends, developments, and carrier outlooks, and this panel will be container sector focused. We're grateful to have with us some key leaders from the container liner and sector industry. Mr. Aristides Pittas, Chairman and CEO of Euroseas, Mr. Thomas Lister, CEO of Global Ship Lease, and Mr. Moritz Fuhrman, co-CEO and CFO of MPC Container Ships. Just a few quick disclaimers and points here just to kick off. First disclaimer, these Capital Link webinars are for informational and educational purposes only. They do not constitute investment advice or advice of any kind. Second, you can submit questions during the session using the Q&A link at the bottom of the screen or emailing them to questions@capitallink.com. We plan for about 45 minutes of panel Q&A discussion, and then we'll address some of the incoming questions for about 15 minutes. Nicholas asked me to remind everybody to please keep all the questions sector focused. Lastly, the webinar will be available for replay on demand. With that, good morning, good afternoon to those overseas. We're going to get into a lot of detail on global trade issues, tariffs, ship rerouting, landing fees, contract rate levels for the operators, and much more with whatever they're willing to provide. But let me turn it over to each of our panelists here for a 1 to 2 minute intro on them and their companies, and then we'll jump into some questions. So Aristides, if you want to go ahead and kick it off.
Yes, hello everybody, and it's nice to be in this panel together with all my distinguished fellow panelists and listed company CEOs. I am very happy to be part of this panel again, and thanks to Capital Link for providing this. Euroseas has been listed in the NASDAQ for more than 20 years now. Actually, we just celebrated 20 years of being listed on the NASDAQ. We are a container owner providing container ship vessels to the liner companies. We own 22 vessels currently, and we are active with smaller vessels between 1,700 and 6,000 TEU, which we feel is a fantastic area to be, and we can say more later on during the conversation.
Wonderful. Tom?
Sure. Hi, everyone. And likewise, many thanks to Capital Link for setting this up and having me on. So Global Ship Lease, rather like Euroseas, is a lessor and owner of container ships. So we provide container ships to the shipping lines themselves. We're listed on the New York Stock Exchange and have been for the last 16 years or so. We have a market cap of 750 million, at least, you know, based on market close yesterday. We own a fleet of 71 container ships. They're also mid-size and smaller and range approximately in size from 2,000 to 11,000 TEU. We aim to provide a stable platform from which investors are able to participate in the upside volatility and upside cyclicality of the industry. We have contracted revenues of 1.9 billion US over a weighted average of 2.3 years. And just to give you a few vital statistics, revenues for 2024 were 711 million. We have a roughly 70% EBITDA margin, so we're throwing off a lot of cash. And we generated annualized EPS of a hair under $10 per share. And given that we're trading only a hair over $20 per share, that's a pretty attractive proposition, I would argue. And we pay a dividend annualized of $2.10 per share, which is a fraction over a 10% dividend yield.
Thanks, Tom. Moritz?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Ken, and also from my side, good morning and good afternoon, everyone. I represent MPC Container Ships, which in this group is the youngest company. We've been established in 2017, listed on the Oslo Stock Exchange, and I can only echo Aristides by saying that 1,700 to 6,000 TEU is a fantastic segment to be in, which is also the focus of MPCC. So we're exclusively focused on the feeder segment. We are, from a number of vessels perspective, are the largest tonnage provider in that segment, which with around 60 ships. And similar to my fellow panelists, we have been enjoying a fantastic market over the last couple of years. Also, especially last year, thanks to some of the macroeconomic and global disruptions that we will certainly spend some time on during the discussion today. And so we've been pretty much focused the last 12 months to lock in as much revenue backlog as possible. So obviously trying to lock in the long-term charters. Given the focus on the slightly smaller vessels relative to GSL, for example, our backlog only stands at $1.1 billion, which I think still think is a fantastic figure. And we have also been laser focused the last 3 years or 2.5, 3 years on rebuilding the fleet, divesting some of the older ships and reinvesting the liquidity that we have generated from vessel sales, but also from the operations and the financing activities into more modern, younger vessels, more efficient, also new builds, which also goes then hand in hand with the part of our ESG strategy. Maybe also a topic that we can talk about, the ever increasing regulatory pressure coming from the outside and being imposed on us also as tonnage providers.
Great. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate the quick run-throughs. You know, Aristides, if I can kind of jump in with you, and I'm going to ask a little bit of a long setup question here, just because we did talk to the Port of LA earlier this week in a conference call, and using it as the basis for kind of U.S. imports, right, which West Coast ports, right, about 30% to 40% of all volumes go through the port. It looks like volumes had been running about 900,000 TEUs per month from July all the way to this January. Fell down to about 800,000 February, March. Looks like April's going to be down to 700,000. And now, just based on some of the things we're hearing about the pre-bookings, looks like it's going to fall sub 700,000 TEUs. How should we think about trade volumes last year and into the tariff impact on global trade and into the U.S.? Any way to set the stage for us as we get into this discussion?
Yes, thank you, Ken. Let me try and pin this on a global insight, because shipping is a global business. The US is an important part on container trade, but obviously what happens globally affects this business. And let me backtrack a little bit and say that according to Clarksons, in 2021, when we had the COVID breakthrough having started, we saw a very significant trade growth in containerized trade. We saw a global 6.6% increase in containerized trade, and that had to do with the COVID and the demand for finished goods globally, since people could not spend in going out and enjoying themselves or on holidays. So 2021 was a great year for trade. 2022 and 2023 were very poor years for trade. And only last year, in 2024, we saw a very significant restocking again, and the world starting to take in more goods globally, and we had you know, nearly 6% of trade growth during 2024, which was very good. But as you said, and as we see already in the States, the numbers have been going down in the States and globally during the last 4 or 5 months. After the election of Trump and the uncertainty that this has created. So indeed, trade into the US, but trade elsewhere as well, is showing some signs of weakness, not particular weakness. I don't think we are seeing panic, but people are trying to play around the tariff idea and see when to import things and what to import. And I think really looking forward, it's very difficult to make a prediction of what is going to happen. Very short term, and because, you know, currently Mr. Trump is saying that for 3 months he will be negotiating, we all expected trade to drop. But now that he's negotiating, people might take the opportunity to restock quickly before any tariffs really apply. So we have to see what happens. I think that short term, we will not see this drop that you suggest, less than 700,000 TEUs into the US in the next couple of months. I think we will see a slight push on that. And what happens afterward will really depend on the tariffs and the deglobalization question that is being asked here. Because what we see in this, globally is this protectionism by the US, but also by other countries, everybody worrying that somebody else will not deliver. And that might cause deglobalization, less trade, things which are not good for us. I generally believe that market dynamics and the economy is really what drives the world. And it always makes economic sense to produce where you can produce cheaper and transport, because transport costs are very low. I think this policy will win going forward, but we will have a lot of turmoil during the next year. I'm trying to set the stage, Ken, that's it.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I understand the stage, but it just looks like we're in for this air pocket. And I wanted to see if you were seeing it to the extent that it seems like, at least we're seeing the daily kind of numbers starting to look at. I was thinking more near term, because we'll definitely get big term talk, supply, demand in the marketplace and everything else. But I know there's a lot of questions on the tariff impact. So, Tom, with that, let me jump over to you. I know you're a lessor. We talked about the vessels, but your ships are used for global trade. You know, maybe talk a little bit about the tariff impact on trade, you know, and I'm talking from a U.S. perspective here in this discussion, but how are you seeing vessel demand in the market? Are you seeing any residual impact at this point? Are we seeing parking of vessels? I know we're hearing a lot of blank sailings are coming up over the next few months. I know that doesn't impact you directly as yours are long-term leased, but what do you think that is impact on the market there with that sharp of an impact?
Sure. Well, I'll try to address those questions, but also pick up on a few of the points that that Aristidis was making. So maybe just to sort of add some context for the discussion, if you look at global containerized trade, because clearly the prime focus of your question is on the dynamic between the US and China and the impact of those tariffs. So just for those who are perhaps not quite as familiar, US tariffs on China are 145%. China tariffs on imports from the US are now 125%. In terms of US containerized imports as a share of global containerized trade, we're talking about 13.13%, which is perhaps a number which is slightly smaller than many listeners might expect. But of that 13%, roughly 40%, 40%, is coming from China. So the imposition of such swinging tariffs on effectively 40% of the containerized trade flowing into the US is going to have a big impact. And I can't remember if it was in the Wall Street Journal or Reuters, I was seeing that one of the big liner companies, Hapag-Lloyd, were saying that what they are seeing up to 30% of China to US shipments being canceled at the moment. So that would point towards the air pocket that you were talking about. But interestingly, they signaled that a lot of the slack is already being taken up by, I suppose, replacement volumes coming out of Thailand, Indonesia, and Vietnam. So I don't think we will necessarily see a reduction in overall volumes, but what we will see, without a doubt, is a change in trade patterns and, you know, the origins and destinations of cargo flows. And what that tends to mean is that the liner companies themselves need additional capacity because the slight supply chains are becoming more diffuse and more complex. And if you have more complexity, you need more capacity. So that could, ironically, be a stimulus for the likes of Global Ship Lease, Euroseas, and MPC, providers of that capacity into the space. And what the another message that came out of this Hapag commentary is that they're actually downsizing ships in terms of TEU capacity. So they're actually putting smaller ships onto the same trades, so they're constraining capacity in order to maintain pricing discipline while maintaining the same service frequency. And if you're a provider of mid-size and smaller container ships, as we all are on this panel, that could also be another positive. So there's a long time to run in this game, but lots of first, second, and third order effects, which may be unpredictable.
Really helpful, Tom. Thank you. Moritz, you know, he just ended, Tom just ended on kind of talking about rates. Maybe let's jump to that and talk about rates, right? So if we look at FCFI, CCFI, right, which is more Asia to U.S. lanes, I'm just thinking about that, right? We're down to $2,100 per box from Asia to the U.S. Can you talk about where rates were, if you want to broaden it globally, if you want to do particular lanes, where rates were a year ago, where we think recontracting rates are trending now? It looks like from Asia to U.S., Asia to Europe, it looks like we've heard they're trending down about 10% for contract rates. Anything from your point of view? Again, I know you're leasing the vessels to liners that operate them, but maybe your view on what's going on in the market.
Yeah, certainly. As you rightfully said, we're obviously more focused on the time charter side of things, given how we operate. But needless to say that we're also quite focused on the box freight side of things to understand how the market works. And obviously, you have seen quite a disconnect recently between the box freight rate, as you have seen, as you said, trending down, and the time charter rates holding up very nicely. But on the question, where were we some time ago? I think it was roughly 13, 14 months ago, when, thanks to the Houthi rebel attacks in the Red Sea and the subsequent diversion of vessels around the Cape of Good Hope, you have seen the pretty strong increase both on the box rate side, but also on the time charter rate side. So, you know, putting things into perspective and relatively speaking to that time period more than a year ago, you know, looking at current box rate rates, we are probably in line with like 15 months ago, maybe a bit down. But time charter rates are actually 50, 60, 70, 80% up, depending on sort of what size bracket you focus. So it's a very strange market dynamic. And I think, you know, taking a step back and also taking one of the points up from Tom he just made, I mean, where he was trying to, I think, convey the message, yes, there's massive tariffs flying around, and hopefully there will be a big deal by Mr. Trump with China in the foreseeable future. But I think we need to distinguish between sort of sentiment-driven rate development and fundamental rate development. And we have seen, and it's not the first time, we've seen it in 18, 19, so when Trump was at power the first time and when he imposed the tariffs on China, we have seen, I would say, a sentiment-driven dent in the charter rate development. But fundamentally speaking, there was not this huge disruption, and cargo was suddenly disappearing. And yes, we see some liner companies so taking out specific services between Shanghai and the west coast of the US, but you see cargos picking up from Southeast Asia. So it's luckily we still kind of, despite all the protectionism, we're kind of still moving in a free market, and cargo will at one point find their way to its destiny and or destination. Being the US consumer, just talking about the Trans-Pacific route lanes for the time being. So I think it's a point in time perspective that we see now. I think despite box freight rates trending down, we are, and also trending down significantly from where we were 21, 22, I think the current box freight rate Trans-Pacific is still significantly above certain break-even levels from a liner perspective, and then applicable to companies like us and GSL and also Euroseas. Charter rates are holding up very nicely. The most recent fixtures I have seen from broker reports from Euroseas, but also GSL, and from us, is there's no change whatsoever. And why is that? It's probably, I mean, our interpretation is, there isn't this typical churn in the available fleet that you have seen historically in the feeder space, right? Historically speaking, you have been fixing feeder vessels for between 3 to 6 months, I would say. And now, given the still good market fundamentals from a time charter perspective, you're still being able to fix between 2 to 3 years in the feeder segment, and Tom certainly being able to fix longer periods for his 11,000 TEU vessels. And given the duration of the time charters you're fixing, there's naturally a scarcity in the market for available tonnage. And you have a particular liner company that is still buying left, right, and center tonnage. So there's a scarcity, which in our view helps keeping time charter rates level where they are. So basically going sideways, both from a rate level, but also from a duration perspective.
I definitely want to get on the.
Sorry, I was just going to see if I could jump on some of those remarks from Moritz, because, I mean, unsurprisingly, we're seeing exactly the phenomenon that Moritz has just described. So there is this dislocation between charter rates and freight rates. And I would say, in addition to the scarcity factor that Moritz pointed to, and the sort of the limited liquidity in the sector, is the fact that everyone is looking for optionality at a time when uncertainty is so heightened. And for the liner companies, capacity is optionality. If they have capacity, they have options. If they don't have capacity, they don't have options. And in an environment where there is such scarcity, it means that if they need additional capacity, they have to pay up for that capacity. And that's another thing, I think, that is feeding into this curious dislocation between charter rates and freight rates.
Well, I was going to say I wanted to stick on the current market first and then get to the dislocation, but I guess you've already answered the dislocation question. So Aristides, I want to kind of stick with this. You mentioned kind of some volumes. I want to think about just this. Again, I've only got a couple more questions on the near term, but if we think about what's going on now, and I asked you before about the pull, the kind of the flow of freight, and you thought it wasn't going to pull back that much. It seems like, I guess, from that perspective, do you think into North America, given what's going on in this environment, you think there's been a big pull forward in boxes? Is it, like, hey, 70% of what would normally flow through the summer season, came in early, or is it not as feared and you think, hey, it's going to be steady? I think you made the comment before, hey, just anticipate it's not going to be as big flux. I think somebody mentioned it could just come from other places and fill that void in and be more balanced. Maybe your thoughts on a pull forward debate that's going on right now.
Yes, Ken, I really don't see it and would be very disappointed if the volumes that we've seen coming into the US right now are also elevated because of the fears of what could happen. That would mean that the volumes that will come up in the next few months would be very few. if there has been this pull that you're saying. I don't think we have seen that pull. I mean, we might have seen it from a cup from in a few areas with some kind of goods like I don't know, apparel, electronics, things like that. We might have seen a pull there. But generally, for most commodities and low margin commodities, I really don't think that there has been any panic or any drive by people to import more up to now. I think we might see it now with this clear window that Trump has given us of 3 months to negotiate deals regarding tariffs, that now that people might feel a little bit more comfortable that there will be this optional period, we'll try to import a bit more. But I really don't see this pull having transpired. And if I don't know if you have data that shows that, but really, if 700,000 TU coming into the US is pulling ahead, it's re really disappointing. I don't think it is. I think volumes will stay definitely above 700,000 and increase further within the next couple of months. And because I think that, the policy of the US, we know how it is. I go aggressively and say, impose tariffs and but then negotiate into a deal which is much softer, exactly as the deal that we saw with the administration. And I think you have a question later on about it, but I'll touch upon it right now. The issue with the Chinese-built ships coming into the States and anybody who owned the Chinese-built vessel would be penalized. Well, this is not happening. They are trying to just penalize Chinese owners more than, existing Chinese-built ships and other companies that own Chinese-built vessels. So Trump mellows down significantly after he goes out attacking everybody. And I think this is going to happen. And that's why I'm cautiously optimistic that we will not see a reduction in a significant reduction in volumes.
All right. Tom, we mentioned before kind of some of the changing trade patterns. I just wonder if how you see your vessels moved. You mentioned more feeder vessels might be in pull and in use. Is that something, are we seeing more intra-Asia lanes popping up in at this point, or is that a long-term structural kind of move you were talking about just based on regionalization, nearshoring, and the like? I just want to understand kind of trading patterns of the vessels.
I would say it's sort of too early in the game to be able to point to sort of significant reshaping of networks other than, the points I made earlier based upon the remarks of Hapag-Lloyd. But I could perhaps point back to 2019 as a rough proxy. I know it is exactly that, a very rough proxy, but there we saw the US imposing fairly punishing tariffs on China for the first time around. And what we saw as a reaction was, perhaps to Aristides' earlier point, no reduction in volumes, but yes, a change in routing. So we saw cargo coming out of Vietnam and Indonesia, perhaps on the back of being sent there semi-finished from China, then to be finished in Vietnam, Indonesia, and other Southeast Asian locations, and from there onward transported to the US. So in that set of circumstances, we did see not additional volumes moving, but more complexity. And to service that complexity, the use of more feeder and mid-sized and smaller ships of the sorts, each of us are providing. So there's an example. I'm not saying it's going to play out in exactly the same way again, but it does illustrate that markets and trade, it's like water. It will find a way around, a way through. And if you've got highly flexible, operationally flexible assets, which all of us have, mid-size and smaller container ships have the advantage of being able to move and redeploy to pretty much every trade, unlike the really big ships, which tend to be captive to the big east-west trades that have the infrastructure to serve them. Any change in trade patterns will tend to point towards a need for more mid-size and smaller ships. And if there are comparatively few such ships available in the open charter market, that tends to be supportive of earnings for tonnage providers like us. So let's see.
I guess, Maritz, let me kind of take that. Aristides brought up the U.S. trade rep proposal. I guess as a ship owner, I guess we're not really still sure how this works out, right? We've got to wait for the final rules, it sounds like, but a lot of stuff has been put out there. Maybe you can walk us through your thoughts on what is out there, what the risk is. It seems like it's changed from every port you call, which could have caused congestion. Now we're talking about maybe some of what percent or what vessel specific. Maybe just update us on what is the status of the trade rep latest proposal for container and port fees. I don't know if that means you throw in the mix of how many vessels you have that are owned that were built in China versus non-China, and maybe you just talk about what you think those fees can do to the operation. So I'll just throw it your way to just get started, and we can jump in from there.
Yeah, happy to take a stab at the latest news from the U.S. in terms of kind of, I would call it tariffs on Chinese owners of ships. So our interpretation for the time being is that it will be, you know, it will be paid by the operator as kind of an additional port fee. So that is the current working assumption, which means it's obviously not to our detriment. Obviously, you know, a tonnage provider with less Chinese-built vessels has probably a competitive advantage, commercially speaking, over a peer that has purely Chinese-built vessels. But the announcement last week obviously differs from what people have feared to come in terms of vessel tariffs. So I think the most significant one, at least from our perspective, is that vessels below 4,000 TEU are exempted, which is news that we have been very happy about. So in our fleet, there's only two vessels above 4,000 TEU, so that's massively helpful. We know of some American short sea operators that have probably been lobbying very hard in Washington to get to this outcome, because otherwise they would have been in a big mess. And then also, let's call it short-term trading is also being exempted. So if you're trading below 2,000 nautical miles, then you're also kind of exempted. As you said, so you're not being charged as per port call, it's more per voyage. And then it's obviously, as I mentioned before, Chinese-owned and operated vessels and Chinese-built. So I think the first name being penalized that comes to our mind is COSCO and its sister company, OOCL. Our research team, they have been obviously crunching some numbers, what this would mean for COSCO. So assuming a typical 13,000 TEU vessel trading Trans-Pacific and calling Los Angeles, Long Beach, the aggregated cost for port call would be around $8.5 million, which in itself sounds quite chunky. Then again, question is, you know, if you distribute that cost on a per TEU basis, and then again, what is actually being loaded in the TEU? I mean, if you distribute it down on a per sneaker basis, I think this fee is obviously quite digestible. But again, a company, a non-Chinese company calling with non-Chinese-built ship, obviously, again, has a commercially competitive advantage now or over COSCO. So it's going to be interesting how this will play out. Also, one of our expectations will be that there will be new hubs being built up closer to the U.S. ports, that you still have the big Chinese-built vessels going into those hub ports, and then you have feeder vessels providing the necessary link between those hubs and then the Caribbean ports and the US East Coast and West Coast, which then hopefully, and obviously I'm talking my own book, but that should obviously hopefully be helpful for feeder demand going forward.
Wonderful. So we've got about 10 minutes left, in the my Q&A portion before you open up to the floor questions. So I guess I thank you for indulging me on kind of the U.S. related issues and the all these things with tariffs and port fees. So let's just take a step back, Tom. You know, we hit on some of these, you know, as I mentioned, the tariff issues. Let's step back to the overall market, right? So where does the container order book sit in terms of, I don't know if you want to break it up by class size, just overall order book. You know, you can do it by scale, however you want to divide the market up, you know, over 20,000 TEUs, 10 to 20 small vessels, or just overall.
Sure. Well, first of all, you're absolutely right to ask that it be broken up. I think it's a mistake to see either the existing fleet or the order book as a homogenous whole. You have to absolutely look at it by size category. So if you look at the overall order book, it's roughly a 28% order book to fleet ratio. But that order book is very heavily weighted towards the big ships, by which I mean ships of over 10,000 TEU and frankly, ships over 13 or 16,000 TEU. So a very heavy weighting there. And if you then zero in on the sub 10,000 TEU order book, which is really the segment in which all of us play, it's between 10 and 11%, so far more digestible. And then if you layer in the fact that the sub 10,000 TEU existing fleet is aging, because there hasn't been a lot of capital flowing into that space for years, really now. So you're looking at a sub 10,000 TEU fleet, which has a median age of roughly 17 or 18 years. If you were to perform the exercise of scrapping out or netting out any ship that hits 25 years or older between now and the end of 2028, you'd actually see the overall fleet on a net basis, taking in the vessels that are being delivered out of the order book, netting out the overage vessels, you'd actually see the fleet shrink by roughly 6.5% over that period of time. So that's really why it's very, very important to make the distinction between the midsize and smaller, sub 10,000, versus the big ships, because the dynamics are totally, totally different. Beyond that, I guess, you know, there are big questions about fuel and fueling the fleet going forward. And that's another level of uncertainty at the moment, which has frankly helped the providers of midsize and smaller, let's call it tactical tonnage, because given the uncertainty about what will be the fuel of the future and where that fuel of the future will actually be available, there has been a wait and see approach to a very large extent for midsize and smaller tonnage, whereas for the big ships, where it's principally the liner operators themselves that are placing the orders or placing orders via third-party owners against very long-term charters, they're willing to take a view on future fuels, you know, whether it's ammonia or methanol or LNG or dual fuel or blah, 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 and as a result continue to invest in tonnage, whereas for third-party providers such as us, we can't control a number of these variables, which means there hasn't been the significant investment in new tonnage, which means not only an aging existing fleet, but a comparatively modest order book. And one very important point to make is that the order book doesn't deliver from one day to the next. It's spread in terms of deliveries over the course of the next 3 to 4 years. So if you were to order a vessel today, she likely wouldn't be delivered until 2029. So that once again makes at least the segments that we're focused upon, sub 10,000 TEU, much more digestible.
Great. Britt, we just talked about kind of what's going on the supply side. So let's talk about the demand side, right? When, you know, it used to be years ago, it was easy to throw out global trade was 2x global GDP, and then you knew what, you know, global GDP relative to US GDP, right? So where does that relationship stand now in terms of global trade? It seemed to move one for one into line with global GDP for a while there, especially as you think about ordering new vessels. How do you look at the market rate of growth?
Yeah, it's I think it's incredibly difficult to sort of model out the demand side of things, and it's been a good exercise in the past to apply a certain GDP multiplier to what the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund has been forecasting in terms of GDP growth, and then apply a 2x multiple. And I think the multiplier effect is, as you said, it's going to parity, if at all, or maybe negative to a certain extent. And irrespective of that, I think historically speaking, demand has always been growing. There has been some dents, thanks to the financial crisis and the COVID times, and I think also 2023, we have seen some negative growth. But I think there, as always, there's a mean reversion. So long term speaking, the demand side will grow, and I think the big, the big factor which is then impacting, as always, the shipping market is the supply side of things. As Thomas just pointed out, there's a tendency in shipping to heavily overbuild, and then muddle through the consequences, as we've seen in the past. I think this time around, dynamics are a bit different for the reasons mentioned by Tom. So I think, supply side, fundamentally speaking, the feeder segment is actually quite interesting. But demand side of things, irrespective of the tariffs that are being imposed by the U.S. government, and also equally by the Chinese government, I expectation is there was hopefully a deal in the foreseeable future. So that sort of wild card is being deleted, and that we see, and I think the forecast by the typical brokers for GDP growth, but also for container shipping demand growth, is around 3 to 2%. And then obviously we're still benefiting from the Red Sea wild card, which at least based on our numbers is adding an additional 11-12% artificial demand, I should say, to the market, which at some point it will be resolved. The jury is still out when this will happen. But so from that perspective, we're actually in a situation where, despite the very large order book, the demand side, at least for the time being, is absorbing the supply. And then from our perspective, what's the assessment? So we're not simply looking at the demand side and say, okay, we believe the market is growing 2 to 3%, let's order some ships. We're much more focused on managing residual risk. So ideally, when we order, we have a long-term charter that is basically mitigating, ordering a ship at arguably historically high pricing, one, and two, and also specifically looking at the supply side of things. And again, I don't want to repeat what Tom has said. I think it's incredibly interesting to look at the supply side, and Tom has mentioned the scrapping, and we've been talking about scrapping for quite some time. We haven't seen scrapping for obvious reasons. The market is just too good, but we believe scrapping will become very much relevant in the foreseeable future, thanks to the latest regulatory burden that has been imposed, which is the IMO Global Carbon Tax. And when that is being introduced in 2028, unless things will change, obviously it needs to be ratified. But when that will be introduced, so many vessels in the feeder segment, because of age, will be uneconomical to operate. So, I think that will be the latest point in time when we see probably a big shift on the scrapping side of things, which will then lead to negative fleet growth, as pointed out before. So, from an MPCC perspective, again, we're looking at, ideally combining with a long-term charter, that you kind of isolated from what's happening in the market around you and whether demand is growing or shrinking. And managing residual risk, and then also identifying which particular subsegment makes sense from a supply side perspective.
Ken,
All right, I'm going to
may I
squeeze
just
two more
may I
in, and
just
then yeah,
sorry, I
Tom,
was
go
just going
ahead.
to pick up on something that Moritz said then, which actually also goes to a question I've spotted in the Q&A. I fully agree with Moritz that growth of containerized cargo volumes are more or less on a one-on-one basis with GDP. It's a fairly mature industry, so that's unsurprising. However, there is one exception, which is refrigerated cargo, where we're actually continuing to see growth that runs significantly ahead of growth of dry cargo. And in part, that's because as refrigerated technology improves, it means that cargoes that would originally have been flown can be moved via sea. So with the exception of dry cargo, which is a mature industry and growing comparatively slowly, refrigerated cargo is growing more rapidly. It's also higher value cargo. And so to the question in the Q&A, that's why there is significant value commercially in having ships that are able to carry a heightened proportion of refrigerated cargo. I think there was an analysis recently that looked at CMA CGM as the liner which had the highest proportion of reefer carrying capacity in its fleet, which is roughly 23% as a share of nominal carrying capacity. And I think we've got, running that same calculation, roughly 26% of our fleet. So that's attractive to the liner companies because it's growing, and it's attractive to the liner companies because the freight rates for refrigerated cargo are materially higher for them. It's more lucrative cargo than dry cargo.
Wonderful. Thanks, Tom. And thanks for jumping in on the question ahead of time. I just want to get two more in from my perspective here, and then we got some time for Q&A. Aristides, the new alliances, right? We've seen reshaping of the alliances that are users of your fleets. As Gemini, now Maersk, Capag, Team Up, MSC moves on its own, is there a renewed chase for market share that you think become uneconomical buyers of excess capacity? And so we have, in, I guess, uneconomical demand for excess supply as they go for scale. And then on the flip side, let me throw it your way, the thoughts on how and when the Red Sea reopens and what that means for container shipping on the other side, right? So now we would shrink some of that excess demand. So let me throw both those, one on the alliances and then the Red Sea.
Sure. And before answering these two very good questions, I just wanted to add on what Moritz said, and then Tom added as well, regarding the GDP to trade growth ratio. We have to remember that containerized business industry, the containerized industry, is extremely modern. It started in the mid-80s. Up till then, we didn't have containerized trade at all. So obviously, it was growing at a much faster rate than the rest of the world. But it was growing at 4, 3, 2, and now it is around 1. And it can go lower if we have deglobalization. It can go higher if globalization continues. This is one thing to follow and see. But the ratio of 1-to-1 is broadly, where we all would expect that to be, with the exception that of the reefer trade that Tom said, which indeed is a relatively modern business as well. We didn't have refrigerated containers 20 years ago. They started having them and replacing refrigerated ships. So this is still a growing area, which was very well addressed by Tom. Now, coming to your question on the alliances, what we've seen here is really MSC grow tremendously. They've added more than 400 ships during the last 2-3 years. They now control more than 20% of the market, which is a huge number. The highest percentage ever. They are bigger than anybody. And they decided to go it alone. So that's why we had the change in the alliances. And they are going for scale. It's we can see that. They are going for as much scale as they can. Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd and the other two alliances, the Asian Alliance and the Ocean Alliance, They are more careful on how they go about it. It's really MSC that is pushing and going for scale. So that's where we stand on that. On the Red Sea issue, this is the only area which I think poses towards all of us some worries that we might see a correction in our market. This ought to happen. I think Thomas Moritz said that, the demand growth, the apparent demand growth due to the Red Sea was about 11%. This is a huge percentage that if that stops, we will see too many ships being in the market. And although I totally agree with everything that Moritz and Tom have said regarding how our smaller vessels are more isolated and they will be even more in need with all this disruption that is happening in the world, still, to reduce the need, by 11%, the demand is going to be quite significant. And although it's going to affect the bigger ships much more, it will even affect us as well. When will this happen and how rapidly it will happen, it remains to be seen. I don't think that this is some, I used to think that, last year that this would be resolved in 2025. It doesn't seem that we will see the resolution in 2025, even if there is an agreement reached and everybody trusts that they will hold and all that stuff. It will take a lot of time for people to feel confident that they can go through the area. So I think we're talking about a 2026 event if, we have some stability in the world on the geopolitical issue. But it's a total unknown.
Wonderful. Thanks, Aristides. Moritz, I'm going to combine three questions coming in to you. One, is it realistic to build container ships in the U.S.? How much do you think? If so, what kind of premium would we be talking relative to Korea, China, Japan? Two, the kind of follow-up to that is, what percent of your ships are constructed in China? What percent of the total order book is being constructed in China? So three questions, but all thrown your way.
Yeah. Perfect. And being mindful of the time, I will try to be brief. So the shipyard question, U.S. shipyard capacity, I think technically yes, economically no. I think the answer is very simple. There is a good reference point in the market. I think Matson, they have ordered a couple of years ago 3,500 TEU vessels for, I think it was 350 million. More or less, give or take. So that premium applied to a similar ship being built in Korea and China, you talk about 450% premium. So then also, so it's just the sheer cost, because labor cost obviously is higher and welding and steel, etc. But I think also the lead time, I think efficiency wise, US shipyards will not be able to provide the same efficiency as Far Eastern shipyards. So ordering a ship, the lead time will not be 2 to 3 years, will probably 5 years. Interestingly, you have the former DU taking over a Philly shipyard. You have another, a few other sort of reaching outs into the U.S. shipbuilding industry from Korea to see whether there's joint ventures to be established. What it would mean, jury is still out. Maybe there's a way to circumvent some of the regulation by building some of the steel in the Far East and then ship over to the U.S. and do the final welding in the U.S. shipyard, and maybe doing that and still being compliant with the regulation and the laws, you can sort of reduce the cost significantly and also reduce the lead time. So maybe that's the way that we might see going forward. But I still don't think, in terms of output of vessels, the US will not be able whatsoever to replace a meaningful capacity that is still in China and Korea, and also Japan to a certain extent. Our fleet is, I would say, luckily, we have less than 40% of our vessels being built in China. The rest is built Korea, Germany, and Taiwan. And from a global capacity, to be honest, admittedly, I don't have the figures on top of my head. Maybe Tom or Aristides have them. But the lion's share of container vessels is being built in China, and distinguishing between the large vessels and the small vessels. So the feeder vessels are almost exclusively built. Built in China. Euroseas, they have some vessels from Korea, and also recently Capital has been ordering some vessels. Japan has a very small chunk, and then larger vessels, I think it's more equally split between the big yards in Korea and also China. So also from that perspective, it will be very hard for the US shipbuilding industry to replace economically viable, meaningful capacity that currently sits in China and Korea.
Yeah, I have the data that Ken.
Tom,
sorry,
let
that...
Aristides jump in. I think he's got
something. Oh, sorry. Sorry. Go on.
No, I was just going to say that I think the only way that the US can revive their economy, their shipbuilding capacity, is if they subsidize it. I mean, they might take, you know, the fees that they make from the ships that come into the US and say, we'll use all that to subsidize our shipyards. They have to do stuff like that in order to compete, because there's no way they can compete within the next 10 years with the efficient yards of the Far East. Absolutely no. And just to answer, yes, we have three out of our 22 ships being built in China, so that's less than 15% of our fleet.
Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, I'm a data nerd, so I've got some data points that that Moritz was reaching for. So if you look at the existing fleet on the water today, 28% is built in China. If you look at the order book, global order book, 71% is being built in China. So it's no small task to try to substitute. And as far as the GSL fleet is concerned, we have a total of 10 ships that are Chinese built, but of those, six are under 4,000 TEU, so they fall outside the USTR levy, at least as currently structured. So we've got four Chinese slash USTR compatible ships, and of those, none are calling in the US.
Great rundown. Thanks, Tom. So maybe I want to come back, Moritz. Let me come back to you again. Somebody just a question was just trying to put together the fact that volumes are falling. You know, as I opened the call with, right, in terms of what's booked from Asia to the U.S. And the questioner was just asking, is that being fully replaced by trade from Vietnam, Thailand to the U.S.? Was that the perspective from the panelists that it's a reallocation of trade, at least in the near term? They're just trying to understand kind of the perspective of what's going on global trade.
Yeah, I would say near term wise, there will probably not a one for one replacement of Chinese cargo just being rerouted through other countries that haven't been imposed with such strong tariffs. Because also other countries have tariffs, and there will certainly be cargo that is being canceled of, you know, shipping costs or importing costs, not shipping, but importing costs being too high. So that's the obviously the near term view, and again the human psychology pretty much works around sentiment, right? So, you know, as we have seen in the capital markets over the last couple of weeks, the huge sell-offs because people are just being scared and now streaming back into the stocks. So I think that is maybe equally applicable to at least to a certain extent on the container side of things, that over time, and I'm not suggesting that over the next 2 weeks we see things being, you know, as they've been before, but over time, and as I also mentioned before, what we have seen in 2018 and 2019, you will see a sort of a natural rerouting, which obviously takes time. To answer the question, I think near term wise, there will not be a one for one replacement, but over time, and as I said, demand is growing, there will be solutions and free, you know, free market and cargo moving around will find its destination. So long term speaking, I don't see a massive reduction in the imports into US out of Asia.
We've reached our time, but I'm going to do two more questions. Moritz, I'm not going to let you off the hook that easy. I've got a follow-up there. This one is best regards to my friend and longtime ago Aristides, but also to my fellow Lehigh graduate, Ken. Thank you, whoever wrote the question. But so they echo your sentiment, Moritz, in terms of maybe an overreaction. We're starting to see that pause. The question is, does that set the stage for a significant second-half rebound in order to keep the balance? Do you think that's kind of what stage we're setting here in terms of the question?
I have to say yes because I work in the industry and obviously I'm trying to be a salesman. But being in Singapore a couple of weeks ago and speaking to some of the smaller operators, but they also have some good exposure and insight into the US. And many of them and voiced independently a similar opinion on, for example, inventory in the US. their expectation and what they see is that obviously there's now a working through the inventory that we see in the US and that they should be depleted to a level in the next couple of months that you naturally will see some restocking activity. And if timeline, sort of if the timeline is being met, but what the liner companies is suggesting, that will fall into the July, August sort of time bracket, which normally is also the high season for containers, right? When people start to import the Christmas business, etc. So maybe it's wishful thinking, but you know, just you know, listening to the people that are one step closer to the target, many of them are suggesting that we see a certainly a stronger second half of 25 relative to the first half, and that being said, you know, all things being equal and not another negative or positive black swan event as we have seen so many over the last years.
Great. The question obviously is just on timing. We're going to wrap up with one last one. I'm going to mash two questions together. Tom, I'll start with you, and then Aristides, I'll go to you because there are two kind of questions thrown in here. But there's currently the disparity, and I think, Tom, you were talking about this a little bit, between what's going on in charter rates and then container spot rates. You know, obviously one's firming, the other one's depressed. Can you maybe delve into a little bit about why this is, and can charter rates continue that follow through with that? And then do you expect the liner operators to then renegotiate charter rates at some point this year? You mentioned you've got long-term contracts. I don't know if there's rolling and you've got an X percentage that are coming up this year, but how should people think about the ability for the liner companies to renegotiate in that environment?
Sure. Okay. Question one I'll take first. The disjoint between charter rates and freight rates. I think it goes back to what Moritz and I were saying earlier. So it's a function of scarcity of tonnage in the charter market and the value of optionality for the liner companies in a situation of heightened uncertainty. And so if they want ships, they have to pay up to get those ships. Over time, charter rates tend to correlate much more closely with freight rates. So there will ultimately, one would expect, be a convergence between one and the other, but we're not seeing that anytime soon. In terms of your second question, it's hard to say. Any renegotiation of charters would have to be bilateral in nature because these are take or pay contracts. So there is not scope for a line simply to come to a tonnage provider and say, listen, guys, we're going to be paying less from this point forward. That would lead to lawsuits. What there may be is if there's a win-win out there, and we saw this back in the wake of the global financial crisis, where it actually made sense both for tonnage providers and for charterers to negotiate a lower for longer on an NPV neutral basis. We haven't heard anything of that nature yet, but that's something that we did see in the very depths of the post-financial crisis market. I'll pause there.
Aristides, I'll leave it to you for any closing thoughts there.
I just want to say I totally agree with what Tom said or on both questions. On the second question, I want to, you know, to ascertain the markets that all the liner companies, at least the major liner companies, are extremely have a very strong balance sheet. They have made huge amounts of money over the last few years. They are sitting in a very strong balance sheet. I do not fear at all that they will come and renegotiate. They are indeed maybe facing this difficulty of high charter rates and low freight rates. They might not be that profitable, but there is no way that they will renegotiate anything else than what Tom said. Even that, I don't think that we will be seeing it anytime soon. I mean, we have to wait for a couple of years. They are they have very strong balances. So that's it.
Wonderful. Well, if I just sum up kind of the conversation a bit here, right? So tariffs and everything we're seeing right now creates a lot of uncertainty, creates opportunity for the industry. the order book, while sizable, you know, Thomas, as we broke it down, better for smaller carriers. You know, there's certainly the disparity in rates kind of highlights the scarcity for some of the asset owners. You've got a lot of issues going on in the container shipping sector, whether it's the Red Sea, which is chewing up capacity, as Maritz kind of highlighted, the 11% out of the market. You've got the reshaping of alliances. We've got global trade that is kind of balanced, I guess. Now it seems like what used to be a multiplier, now kind of more in line. I think sets up well for continued interest in the sector, for the industry, for global trade. With that, really appreciate you taking the time, Tom, Maritz, and Aristides, for joining us today, and everybody else for dialing in. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you.